the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
We all know there's issues when it comes to estate planning. We have probate, we have incapacity, we have estate taxes. But do you realize sometimes you may be creating problems by the very nature in which you hold title to the assets that you own? Joining us on the program is Adam Sherry. And Adam, you know, people are familiar with wills, they're familiar with living trusts, but they don't understand sometimes that the way they take title to property may mess up their entire estate plan, create tax problems, liability problems, all kinds of issues that they're unaware of. So what I'd like to do, if we can today, is take the different methods of which an individual or a married couple can take title to property. And let's start with probably the biggest asset most people have, which is their home. So I want to cover the various methods from joint tenancy to community property, tenants in common, and talk about the consequences, the good and the bad of each one. And let's begin with the most widely used method of taking title to assets in this country for a married couple, which is joint tenancy. So explain what joint tenancy is and how it works, the good and the bad. Let's begin with joint tenancy.
This is a really great point because some of your listeners may already have their estate plans in place. However, a trust only controls the assets which are held in the name of the trust, which is why holding title to property is so important. So if you were to hold property as joint tenants instead of holding it as trustees of your trust, the way in which title is held is going to take precedence over the terms of the trust. So joint tenancy in particular is a way in which two people can hold property in which they both have an equal interest in the property. And following death, it has a right of survivorship, which means that ownership is going to immediately transfer from one person. They previously owned one half, and then following their death, their one half ownership interest is automatically transferred to the other joint tenant with whom they hold the property. I know we'll have an opportunity to talk about community property and basis a little bit later in the show, but you know, one of the interesting features about joint tenancy is that two people can hold property as joint tenants and they don't necessarily have to be married, which means that, you know, it could be two unrelated persons, siblings, a parent and child. So it's a very common way of holding title to property. And it's often the form that's most recommended, maybe by a real estate agent when somebody's purchasing a home. But as we'll discuss, and I know as you're interested in explaining to your listeners, there's some real drawbacks, especially when compared with the other forms in which one could hold property.
You know, one thing, as you pointed out there, that's very important is, let's say for an estate planning purpose, individuals will set up a living trust. They go to an attorney like yourself. They set up the trust. But a lot of times over the years, they might have, let's say the attorney that set up the trust transferred the deed to the house to the name of the trust. So the house is now in the name of the trust. Fast forward 5-10 years later, they sell the house, they go to another state or someplace else, they buy a house, and the real estate agent does what you just said, they put it in joint tenancy. Explain that, for example, let's say you have a tragedy, and husband and wife are in the car, they get in a car accident, both are killed in the car accident, they have a living trust for their assets, but the house is held in joint tenancy. Explain what happens.
This is such a big issue, and really it comes up much more often than it should. So if it happens that there's a simultaneous death and the property was held in joint tenancy, it kind of leaves the property out there hanging as far as to whom it'll be distributed. And since it's not owned by the trust, a probate action usually needs to be initiated in order to transfer that property into the living trust or the family trust that was established. Now, transferring that property into the trust via probate is exactly why a lot of people set up trusts in the first place, to avoid the time, expense, and public nature, which we've talked about on a prior show, that's associated with probate. And so a thing that seems relatively small, like taking title, has just in effect upended one of the major reasons why they established a trust in the first place.
Let's also talk about two additional issues with joint tenancy. One is additional capital gains taxes and also subject to liability. And let's take capital gains. I own an asset in community property in trust. One spouse passes away. Let's talk about what happens to the capital gains. Let's say I bought a house for $500,000 in California. It's now worth $1 million or even more. And one spouse passes away. It's held in trust or community property versus, let's say, if it's held in joint tenancy. Let's talk about the possible capital gains implications here.
These implications are really serious here. So, you know, we're going to be using a term for the rest of the show that's a step up or a step up in basis. And so, you know, it's the step up that is essential to minimizing or eliminating capital gains tax. So the first scenario that you posed, if husband and wife owned that home as joint tenants, on the death of the first spouse, that property is going to transfer, ownership is going to transfer fully from, let's say, husband owning one half to wife owning both halves. Now, instead of getting a step up in basis, the original basis in the property is actually maintained as it transfers to the surviving spouse. Now, why is that a problem? And how is there something that's a much better approach? So the problem is that if, let's say, the surviving spouse, the wife, were to sell the property prior to her death when it's currently valued at $1 million, she's going to be charged capital gain tax on that entire gain of $500,000. And that's going to lead to some really serious tax implications. Now, if they had held the property as community property, let's say, or some way other than joint tenancy in which the husband's ownership was transferred to the wife, let's say that they held it as tenants in common and it was left to the wife. Now, husband's ownership of a one-half interest in that property would be transferred to the wife. And that transfer, upon death, gets a step up in basis from the original value of the house to its current fair market value. Now, that way, there's a one-half step up in basis that occurred as a result of the husband's death, which is good because it cuts the capital gains tax in half. However, what would be superior would be if, you know, both halves of the ownership interest in the property could be stepped up to the current fair market value. And that's where community property comes in. So if the husband and wife had held the property as community property, so it could either say on the deed that they hold it as, you know, husband and wife as community property with the right of survivorship, or else they clarified that it was community property and held it as trustees of their trust. On the death of the first spouse, instead of one half getting a step up, both halves of the house get a step up to current fair market value, which effectively eliminates the tax on the gain that occurred during the joint life of the husband and wife.
So we have an issue there where you can eliminate capital gains. I've had clients that have had real estate where they've owned the asset in the name of their trust in a community property state like California. And what happened is on the death of the first spouse, and this particular client, the husband passed away, all of the capital gains on the real estate were forgiven, got stepped up to a new market value, and they were able to depreciate the properties at a higher value. In other words, the current market value when they had properties in the estate that had been fully depreciated. So there's also additional tax benefits, especially if you own, let's say, investment real estate.
Absolutely. You know, this doesn't just apply to an individual's residence or, you know, it doesn't just apply to real property. You know, if a person's in a community property state, they can hold all different types of property as community property, and that property is often eligible for the step up in basis. Now, one of the things that you asked me to address was the liability that comes along with holding assets in joint tenancy. And before we talk about this, it's related. I just want to point out something. You know, oftentimes people are tempted in their final years to transfer ownership of property to their family members while they're still alive. And so this step-up concept is a really good illustration of a benefit that could be derived by waiting until after death. So if, for instance, somebody, you know, whether or not they knew it, was within a year or so of passing away, and they decided, oh, I'm going to transfer ownership of my home to my child. But by doing it prior to death, they lose out on that ability to step up the basis. So, you know, it's something that's really important that people are aware of.
I want to address the liability issue because I had a case that was brought to me in the case of a woman who lost her husband. Her main asset was a large home. Upon her husband's death in joint tenancy, the house passed to her. And what she did is she put the house in joint tenancy with her children. Explain to the audience what the liability issues are, because in this particular case, one of the children got in a car accident and they went after the assets of the house.
Yeah, you know, we've talked about this before, and there's just so many pitfalls associated with this. So, you know, it makes sense, and a lot of people kind of do it as a way, like a shortcut around engaging in other forms of estate planning. And so they're looking for that automatic transfer when they pass away that's associated with a joint tenancy. However, in this example regarding one of your clients, it's just a perfect illustration of some of the downsides. So when you transfer ownership of property, let's say, like in this example, from yourself to, let's just say, one of your children, and you now own it as joint tenants, first off, it's really important to remember that even though you're kind of looking towards the future when you're making this transfer, it's a present transfer of an interest. Like, you are really transferring ownership of, you know, half of your house to this other person. So as with any lifetime gift to another person, this may have implications for estate tax or gift tax. So it needs to be recognized that, let's say it was a $500,000 house, a $250,000 gift was just made to that individual's child. Now, with respect to something like the car accident, not only have you made that gift, but the other person truly is an owner of that property. So that means that ownership of that asset is now liable to claims by their creditors. So in the example of a car crash, you know, the creditor here, so let's say that they were sued and a judgment came against the child, they can attach to that house, you know, which can result in having to sell it. And so now mom was focused on an easy way to transfer it from her to her son after she passed away. But because of the manner in which she set that up, she's now exposed her home to potentially, you know, being a forced sale or having to sell off part of it or take out a mortgage. There's very real implications to this.
Now, we talked about the pluses in, I guess, some of the risk to joint tenancy. Let's talk about other forms of ownership or ways to take title to property that are prevalent today. For example, tenants in common and some of the others. I wonder if we could touch upon them briefly, when they're appropriate, the good and bad there as well.
Sure. So a tenancy in common is a form of property ownership in which multiple different persons can own different interests in property. So it's different from joint tenancy in that each party doesn't necessarily own half. So they can own fractional interests that are smaller or larger than 50%. And it's different than community property in that these can be unrelated persons. They could be parent and child. They could be married, but they can also be third parties. So people who have no relationship with each other other than potentially they're interested in investing in this property together. So it offers nice flexibility in that, you know, you don't have to be related to the person. You don't have to be splitting ownership 50-50. But like the joint tenancy, so I mean, in some cases, that really is appropriate, right? There's instances in which, you know, all these different forms of ownership may be appropriate. So that's a way in which unrelated persons can go in together and invest different amounts and own a piece of property together. Now, one of the downsides, just like the joint tenancy, which we discussed, is you truly are owning that property with another person, even though you hold your own little piece of the pie. So that means that, you know, you need to be thinking about the other person, making sure that they are responsible for their share of property taxes, making sure that it's somebody who you could actually almost be in business with and trust that relationship to work out. Now, a tenancy in common, unlike a joint tenancy, it doesn't have that right of survivorship. So in order to transfer ownership following a person's death, you have to take an additional step of making sure that you have covered it somehow in your estate plan.
So maybe one way to avoid probate is, let's say, Adam, you and I decide to go and invest in a rental property. I'm going to take my half, and we're going 50-50 just for illustration purposes. I take my half in the name of my trust. So that way I don't have to worry about the probate issues, and you could still take yours in your own individual name. But can a trust be a co-joint tenant, or let's say co-tenant in common on a piece of property?
Absolutely. And, you know, it's recommended because, as you pointed out, taking ownership in the name of your trust is the best way to avoid the need to take that asset through a probate process in order to transfer ownership following your death. So yes, it can definitely be owned by your trust.
What are some of the other ways to take property? Obviously, if you're a single individual, you can take ownership to a piece of property in your own name or in your own trust. We talked about tenants in common. We talked about joint tenancy. What other forms are out there in terms of taking ownership in a property?
So we're talking right now in California. And so in California and a variety of other states across the country, now not necessarily all states, but there's probably more than 10 states or so in which you can own property as community property. Now, community property has some certain restrictions on it, but if you meet those restrictions and you can hold property as community property, there's also some real benefits. For example, community property can only be held by two married persons. So unlike tenants in common or joint tenancy, in order to hold this property as community property, you're going to have to hold it with your spouse. Now, like joint tenancy, community property, it's eligible to be held with a right of survivorship. One of the interesting things about community property is that you really do own half of it. And so that means that if you wanted to, you can choose to leave your ownership interest in that community property to your spouse. Or if you proactively indicated that you did not want to do so, you could leave it to any other person who you might choose. Now, one of the benefits of community property, which we've touched on briefly, is that it's eligible for that double step up in basis. So if you do own community property with your spouse and they become the owner of your community property interest after death, you're able to get that full step up in both halves of the property, despite the fact that only one spouse has passed away. And, you know, as we illustrated, that can lead to some real benefits when it comes to minimizing capital gain.
I want to talk about another issue that we find ourselves in this country, especially with 50 different states that came into the union at different times. In the Southwest, you have states that are community property, like the state of California, and you have, like, for example, Arizona or, let's say, Nevada. There are other states known as dower and curtsy states. Can you explain to our listeners the difference between, let's say, a community property state such as California or Arizona and dower and curtsy states, which you find in the Midwest and on the East Coast?
I'm happy to. And, you know, it's a really significant difference. And so the difference is found really, legally speaking, in the presumptions that come along with that property. So, for instance, if husband and wife acquire property during marriage, and let's say they use their wages that they earn to purchase it, California is going to presume that that property is held as community property, you know, which qualifies it for those benefits that we just discussed. However, that same couple, if they were to, let's say husband was the primary breadwinner in the house, and so they were to purchase property, and so they're in a dower or a curtsy state somewhere in the Midwest, and they were to purchase that same property, well, that property, instead of being presumed that it was one half owned by husband and one half owned by wife, it may be presumed that it is fully owned by the spouse who earned the money that was used to purchase the property. So that's a really different outcome based on a different legal assumption in a particular state.
So you could have an issue, technically, Adam, in one of these states. Let's say the husband was the main breadwinner, mom stayed at home, let's say during the first 2 decades of the marriage because she was raising the kids. So under that kind of, let's say, dower or curtsy state, it could be presumed that the house belongs to the husband.
Yeah, and that has really serious implications. For instance, let's talk about it in the context of death or divorce. So when it comes to, let's say, a distribution on death, the assumption in such a state is not that each spouse owns one half. So in California, a community property state, each spouse is able to designate where that one half of that property is going to go. However, in a dower or curtsy state, the particular laws in that given state may reduce it, let's say, to 20%, 30% ownership interest, because they will presume that the other spouse has a certain ownership interest. Or, you know, the state laws may result in the other spouse having no ownership interest in it. So, you know, it changes state by state. But the big difference that's important to your listeners is that these presumptions really affect people's ownership interest in the property and their ability to, you know, count on that to support them going forward, or to know that they can transfer a particular property or an interest in property to the people to whom they want to transfer it.
How does this apply from estate planning? Because it's pretty straightforward, as we talked here in a community property state, where it's automatically assumed between a husband and wife, 50% is the wife, 50% ownership is the husband. So that, for example, one spouse passes away, you get a step up on the entire property. When you have a dower or curtsy state where it's assumed that, let's say, all of it belongs to the husband, but yet the wife passes away, there's less tax benefits, if I understand this correctly.
Yeah, that's a very appropriate point. So when there's not that shared ownership interest, that means that an event like a death is not going to qualify for the step-up in basis. So if it's presumed under the law that, in our example, the wife who was the homemaker for those first two decades, if it's presumed that she has no legal interest in the specific property and she passes away, well, there's no interest in the property that can be stepped up to its current market value. So whereas in a community property state like California, where, you know, that one half or entire interest in the property gets stepped up to the current fair market value, they may not be eligible for any benefit at all. Now, I want to point out, and I know this is one of the things that we discussed off the air, but these assumptions in different states are important. And what's also important is to consider the fact that certain steps can be taken to signify to the state in a legal manner that, rather than thinking of this as separate property, you know, we want to consider this shared property. And so steps can be taken in order to transfer ownership interests and then make yourself eligible for those sorts of step-ups. You know, in some states, they recognize community property if the spouses take an effort to what's called as transmuting, so just kind of changing the character from separate to community. So just because a person finds themselves in a separate property state doesn't mean that there's not steps they can take to avail themselves of some of the benefits of owning property together.
So, Adam, let's take the listeners to this program that are all over the country. What are some of the things or precautions or steps they should take of, let's say, their estate plan and also examining how they've taken title to property to make sure that everything is in order? For example, you might have set up a living trust, but, you know, you've moved and now your new house is in joint tenancy. What are the steps that are practical that people should be made aware of and what they should do to rectify it? In other words, what are the steps to put their house in order when it comes to estate planning regarding property ownership?
There's plenty of things in our life that we kind of put them on autopilot, and it's worth taking time, just like you're describing, to check in. It's kind of like you're auditing your own financial setup. So in the case of property ownership, it's worth ensuring that your house truly is held in the name of your trust. So for instance, you know, we've talked about the example of purchasing new property. Another example that comes up really frequently is when people refinance. So oftentimes a bank will require that they transfer into their individual names to refinance the property, and then later they have to transfer it back. So this kind of checking in is really important. So one of the things I would recommend is contacting the county recorder's office and confirming how your property is held. So actually looking at the title, either on your deed, take a look oftentimes at your tax statements, your property tax statements. Those will often give you an indication. So, you know, really taking time to look at how it's actually held rather than how you assume it's held, because you know, so many things can occur and we can just assume, and it's only when people pass away or there's a major life event that the reality of it, it takes precedence over our assumption in every case. And, you know, another thing while we're talking about this great idea is to confirm your beneficiary designation. So take a look at your life insurance policies, your retirement plan, and make sure that it's going to the person that you intend it to go to. So that involves contacting whoever it is who handles your life insurance, or maybe going to your financial advisor, who might be a good like central point for all these issues, and asking to review your beneficiary designations to confirm that it's actually going to the person who you want it to go to.
Well, listen, Adam, I want to thank you for coming on the program. If our listeners would like to find out more about the work that your firm does in estate and tax planning, how could they do so, please?
The internet's probably the best way. Our website is AndersonYocum.com. That's Anderson, YOCUM.com.
Well, listen, Adam, as always, thanks for coming on the program. All the best to you, sir, and come back and talk to us again.
I'd love to. Thanks for having me.
Well, that concludes the interview, and I bet for a lot of you listening to this program, this was a wow show. And I hope that if you are in a situation as we described with the various forms of property titling, you have a trust, but you're holding title to a piece of property in a different form. You may not know that, because if you set up a trust and you worked with a good estate planning attorney, he would have taken title and transferred the deed to your home in the name of your trust to make your estate plan complete. But, you know, say you had your trust done 10 years ago. In the meantime, you moved to a new house or a new community or a new state. Your estate plan may be out of order and you may be holding title to property in a way that is disadvantageous to your estate plan. So please follow through with these steps, because folks, I have seen more issues come up. I've seen probate take place when there should have been probate. I've seen gift taxes take place when there should have been gift taxes. I've seen liability lawsuits take place when there shouldn't have been. And I could just tell you all kinds of problems. One example I can think of, 4 children to an estate, quite a few real estate holdings. The main asset was the house itself, and mom puts the house in joint tenancy with one of the siblings when there are 3 others. Guess where the house went? It did not go to the other 3 siblings. It went to the one son. So please pass this around if you can, because we see these issues crop up so often when they shouldn't be. Something you should take rather seriously, because taking title in the manner in which you take title to property, I don't care if it's home, it's investment real estate, a brokerage account, or even the beneficiary provisions to your pension plan and IRA, have huge tax consequences at death. Well, that concludes this week's interview. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you found it informative. We'd like to thank you for tuning in to Lifetime Income. And really, folks, on this one, send it to your friends, because I don't want you or your family members to experience some of the things that we talked about, the negative aspects of which property is taken title to. So in the meantime, until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense. or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.